Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it, all while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, and welcome to the No Bullshit Leadership podcast, brought to you by Intelligence Squared. I'm Chris Hurst, author of No Bullshit Leadership, and in my day job, I'm global CEO of Havas Creative. Leadership is difficult, but not complicated. In this podcast, we cut through the bullshit and get to the heart of modern leadership, which, put simply, is the power to get stuff done and make stuff happen. In each episode, I'm joined by a different inspirational leader who is doing just that, leading change in their worlds of business, sport, or politics. My guest today is Rula Khalaf, the editor of the Financial Times. In January 2020, Khalaf became the first female editor in the FT's 134-year history. Rula's path to the top of the FT was not via the City of London, but through her work as a foreign correspondent. Born in Lebanon, she served as the FT's foreign editor, reporting from Iraq, Iran, and Syria, and covering the Arab Spring. She now manages 600 journalists across the globe as editor of one of the world's most respected and recognizable publications. Welcome to the podcast, Rula.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
So I feel like I kind of have to start in January 2020. So there you are. You get a big job. You must have turned up and had, as we all do, you know, big plans and big visions for all that you were going to do. And then you find yourself, presumably like the rest of us, running a global organization via Zoom. How was it?
Well, yes, it was 6 weeks before the world fell. I took over, and we had to everything changed in a matter of days. And as you say, I obviously came in with big plans and a lot of ambition. And it was obviously frustrating that I had to deal with something else. But there was also an upside, and that is that I had to focus all my time, all my attention on running the newspaper. So I didn't have anything else that I had to worry about. Mm-hmm. And I think that helped us both in our coverage and in making us more sustainable and more secure as a business.
And so did your priorities for the paper change as a consequence? I mean, obviously in the short term, you were talking a lot about COVID, I guess, but in terms of your medium-term ambitions, long-term ambitions?
Yes and no. So what I tried to do is delay a little bit some of my longer term ambitions. I'll give you an example that I came in and I wanted us to do a lot more on climate change, because I thought that is of great concern to business leaders, even those who didn't realize it at the time. And so I moved more slowly on the projects and focused a lot more on coverage and how we cover the pandemic. And one of the things that surprised me is that I didn't think, and I think none of us thought, that, you know, we were a huge authority in science and health. Mm. And yet what I discovered is that we had a lot of great assets. And so we put a team together and through our data journalism as well, really leveraged our data journalism. And we were able to establish ourselves as an authority. The other thing I did was that I felt that reliable, authoritative information was very badly needed at that time. And so I made some of our coverage free, which was something that was new. I mean, we did in the past make some coverage very, very rarely free. But I decided, and I got the board approval to make some of the some of our best and most authoritative coverage of the pandemic, including data journalism, free to read. And what was really interesting to me is that our subscribers actually really, really appreciated this. I got a lot of emails saying, I am glad that you're doing this, and I am willing to pay for others to be able to access this information freely.
Well, that's fascinating, because it actually takes me to one of my later questions, but I'll throw it in now. This is very much a personal opinion that I'd like your view on. But I feel that recently, let's say, given the enormity of the challenges that the world faces, so we've touched on two. We've got COVID, we've got the climate change, we've now got Ukraine. I feel sort of empirically that serious news organizations have started to take, let's say, a more muscular position on essentially truth and lies, on addressing things like, you know, false equivalences, whether that be anti-vaxxing or whether it be Kremlin propaganda or what have you. Do you think that's, first of all, do you think that observation is fair? And what do you think of it?
I think that, as you know, trust in media has been declining. And what happened during the pandemic, largely because quality news organizations and authoritative news organizations did very well and covered the pandemic very well. I think that trust has started at least to be restored. There is research that shows that trust levels have increased, and I think that encourages everyone to keep going. We are obviously a business. And we know that quality journalism is very expensive to produce. But I think that I feel, and I think everyone at the FT feels, that we also have a public service role to play. And therefore, in a world of fake news and growing propaganda and the ability to propagate this propaganda so easily through social media, it is our job to make sure that the truth is told and that the truth is spread and that more people have access to it.
So I definitely want to come back to issues around transparency, but before that, I want to take you back to your childhood. I mean, it's fascinating listening to you talk so passionately about the FT being a global organisation, and you grew up in Beirut. Do you think that gives you a different perspective to people that preceded you, and I guess your peers in other Western-based news organizations?
I don't know that it gives me a different perspective, because I think that the FT has always been a global organization, and certainly my predecessors had worked in different parts of the world. I think that, you know, I am a very international person. I grew up in Beirut. I studied in the US and spent 10 years in the US, and then moves to London. So obviously my outlook is very international. But we also have a large part of our readership in the UK, and so we have to remain anchored in the UK.
Mm. And I mean, you grew up during the Civil War in Beirut, is that right? I mean, can you tell us a bit about what that was like?
It was strange, unusual.
It didn't seem unusual to me.
No, it didn't seem unusual to me. And I think that whatever situation you're in, you adapt. The civil war in Lebanon was not one continuous conflict. Yeah. So there were periods of very violent conflict. And then you would think that there's a ceasefire for several months. So in fact, I moved for 1 year to, my family moved to Egypt for 1 year. And then later on, we moved to Greece, to Athens for some time. And at one point, we also moved to London. And so it was constant movements and constant change, but you do adapt. And I think children also create their own world. Their world becomes their family. And I think that as long as you feel protected by your family, then you feel the trauma of war a little bit less. But we certainly moved around a lot, and there was this black bag that my parents always had that had our passports, money, and it was the bag that we all knew where it was because we knew that there would be times when we'd just have to grab it and move on.
And so where is home for you? Now, when you think of home, where do you think?
Home is right here, right now, where I am.
home is a British Airways lounge or something.
it's actually my home is in London. This is where my children grew up. But I also still think of Lebanon as home, and my father is there, and I go and visit him. But that's not where I live anymore, and I haven't lived there since I went to college. And I made a deliberate decision that I wanted to live in the UK and to be a British citizen. So that is my home.
This is a slight sort of in parentheses question, but you're a financial journalist. We've talked about Beirut. I have to ask you about one of Beirut's most famous inhabitants at the moment, Carlos Ghosn. So when I was fortunate enough to be at Harvard, so that was about 15 years ago now, we did a whole case study about, Carlos Ghosn, this incredible, it's a podcast about leadership, an incredible global leader. I don't want to put you too much on the spot, but what do you make of that story? I mean, it's an astonishing, I can't think of a parallel to what's happened to him.
Yeah, it's a spectacular rise and a spectacular fall of one of the world's leading businessmen. But I think it's also a story of hubris. And to a certain extent, possibly greed. I think that sometimes you can get carried away with the power that you accumulate. And I think that is a typical example of that.
Yeah. For those listening to the podcast, if you don't know who Carlos Ghosn was, he was the CEO of Nissan Renault, essentially, and was prosecuted in Japan and had a very spectacular escape. And if people do want to know more, I don't work for the BBC, but there's an amazing storybook documentary about him. It really is. It's like a...
Listeners can go back and read what we wrote in the...
Of course. I mean, sorry, of course.
Because we had great coverage of the Ghosn affair.
Of course, we'll go back and read it in the Financial Times. Your first job as a reporter, I believe, was for Forbes in the early 90s, where you reported, I guess, on the 1990s, late 90s, pre-crash excesses of Wall Street. And from one, let's say, anti-hero leader to another, Carlos Ghosn to Jordan Belfort, the Wolf of Wall Street, who I believe you met. What was he like?
Well, let me first say that the Wolf, for those who did see the film, it was nothing like the film, really. He was not on Wall Street to begin with. He had a shop in Long Island, and it was a penny stock shop. So I came across him through... some, you know, short sellers and people in the business who were looking at dodgy outfits. And I started looking into him, and I knew that there was something not quite right in his business. And then when I contacted him, he was so happy to be contacted by Forbes, because that seemed to him to be like, you know, he'd arrived. And so he was very happy to be interviewed. And it was, of course, at the end of my research that I got in touch with him. And I remember he came into the office and was full of confidence, and was therefore very shocked when the story came out. And the story was never called The Wolf of Wall Street. Then when he went to jail, eventually he wrote a book. And he described me in the book as an insolent reporter but he does say, I think, that I was clever too, which was good of him. And I think this is, it's the book that then, you know, was turned into a Hollywood film, which I thought the film was dreadful, by the way.
Yeah, my kids love it. But there you go. That probably says it all. So sort of from the sublime to the ridiculous. So you left Forbes, and then you were reporting on the civil war in Algeria. You worked in Iraq, Iran, covered the Arab Spring. I mean, incredibly tumultuous times. Is that because you've been drawn towards them, or is that how it's just worked out?
I don't think so. It was definitely a dream of mine to cover the Middle East and to be a foreign correspondent. But I think what happened was that because it was a case of continuous crisis, my editors would always say, well, do this, you know, stay, do this now. Yeah. And, you know, if you ask me, you know, one thing that I do regret is that I think I spent far too much time covering one region. But the region kept changing.
Yeah.
And the region is actually quite versatile and unbelievably volatile.
Yeah.
And so I went from one crisis to another, and I learned how to cover crises. Like, what do you do when you're covering a big crisis?
Yeah.
And I think that definitely helps me today in coverage of Ukraine, for example.
Yeah.
I think you also develop a certain, you know, understanding of what it's like for people and what it's like for reporters on the ground, but what it's also like for the people who they are covering, you know, living through very difficult circumstances, living through trauma. And I think, you know, probably that helps.
I'd love to talk to you or hear you talk a little about your leadership style. How would you describe it?
I like to describe it. This is a question obviously better answered by others at the FT, but I like to think that I'm fair. I'm sure that I'm relentless. I like to think that I'm approachable, and that, you know, people know that they can come in and talk to me. I've definitely tried to spread the message that I like to listen, and that I'm willing to talk about everything. And that, you know, people can just email me or, you know, knock on my door and come in.
And so it's been a tumultuous 2 years. Has that taught you something about yourself as a leader, given the, you know, the extraordinary nature of events?
I think it taught me a lot about management.
Mm.
I think that the pandemic required a completely different style of management. And that's certainly something that I hadn't anticipated. And when I speak to a lot of leaders in the business community, they found also that management during the pandemic was different, because it wasn't just about the work. It was also about how people have adjusted to a completely different lifestyle, and a much more difficult lifestyle. They had to juggle homeschooling and work. There was a lot of mental pressure, people getting sick or their relatives were getting sick. And I think that in my discussions with CEOs and business leaders, I think everyone has found that you needed to pay attention to more than the work that the staff is producing. You needed to really to be a lot more caring, a lot more sympathetic to what people were going through. And I think that is something that will continue long after the pandemic, because the pandemic created this new concept of flexibility. Mm. And I think that there is a lot of benefit to flexibility. People have discovered a much better work-life balance. And I think that we have to try to preserve some of that while at the same time, bringing people back to the office and recreating or rejuvenating the collaboration, the creativity that comes with people being together.
I agree entirely with that. I think that there are things that you can't do without having everybody together at least some of the time. But I also think there's a lot of things you can do remotely or in all sorts of different shapes and ways of doing it. And I think hybrid working or whatever you want to call it, I'm an optimist about that. I think there is a genuine opportunity for a win-win, not just enabling people to get a better work-life balance, let's say. But I think there are opportunities for organizations to work in different, more collaborative, more imaginative ways.
Well, this is what we've been trying to do. We started in March with a new hybrid working system and, with 3 days a week where I wanted everybody to actually be together in the office rather than teams, deciding I'll be in on Monday and somebody else will be in on Tuesday, so that we can try to get the best of both worlds.
I mean, that's for what it's worth, our businesses are different, obviously, but that's what we do. That's in London and elsewhere in the world. And it works really well for us. Of course, nothing is perfect. There's always challenges.
And I think that the challenge is also that there will always be people who think we should go back completely to the way we were, and people who think you don't have to be there at all. Yes. And I spent a lot of time trying to explain why I made the decision, why I reached the decision that I had reached about, the 3 day altogether, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And I had, in fact, talked to a lot of other business leaders about this just to see what they had, and I'd read a lot of research. As you know, there has been a lot of research. So I think that it makes sense to me. We'll see when we review it this summer what others at the FT think.
You mentioned earlier transparency and diversity, and your predecessor Lionel Barber wrote of the newsroom, "One day I'll deal with the alpha male problem, but not today." And you've also previously said there were days at the FT where you were the only woman in the room. It's taken over 100 years for the FT to have a female editor. How much resistance have you had to deal with? And indeed, have you dealt with the alpha male problem?
Okay. First of all, I think Lionel was very, very genuine, and he really did want to deal with the alpha male problem. And we talked about it a lot when I was deputy editor. And I think that was probably one of the reasons that he had appointed me as deputy editor. I don't like to think of it as an alpha male problem. I like to think of it as, and that is indeed how I think of it, you need a diversity of views, because that makes for better journalism. It makes for more creative ideas. It makes for a much more interesting debate. And I think that what I have tried to do is to have enough women in the room at every level of the organization. And what I found is that in some ways it is easier to get it at the top levels of the organization because you can promote people. But where it is more difficult is in the middle. So we hire at least 50% newcomer, younger generation who come into the FT. At least 50% and often more than 50% are women. And at the top levels, we're about 45% now, and I hope that we'll be 50% very soon. But I think that in the middle level, this is where I still have work to do. And I think that I'm often looking for, you know, women who may have left journalism for one reason or another and want to come back into journalism. And I'm very keen to hire women in those levels that may be, you know, running a desk or running a team. So in team leadership positions.
And your path to the top was, I guess, not through the city, which I suppose traditionally the heart of financial reporting. Do you think that you personally have had to fight more for recognition because of a rather unorthodox route?
I'm not sure that I had to fight more for recognition because I had been at the FT for a long time. And I think that I had the respect of my colleagues. The fact that I had been deputy editor for several years, so I helped to run the newspaper on a day-to-day basis, especially at a time when the editor was traveling quite a bit, and I had the confidence of the editor. So I think everyone saw me doing the job on a day-to-day basis. Obviously, being deputy editor is very different from being editor, because you can always go to the editor for the final decision, and now every final decision rests with me. But I think everyone had seen me doing the job, so there was nothing terribly unusual in my running conference every day, and I would do it for, you know, sometimes, you know, one or two weeks at a time. And so I think that I had the respect and the confidence of the newsroom. Mm.
I like that observation about the difference between being nearly at the top and being at the top.
And it's a challenge to many people. Very, very different.
Yes. Well, exactly. And it's a challenge that many people face at different points in their career. How would you characterize that, what seemingly is a small leap, but in reality is quite a big leap? What were those big differences?
I think the main difference is exactly what I was saying, is as deputy editor, you help to solve a lot of problems. A lot of people come to you because they don't want to go see the editor. You try to bring solutions to the editor, and you try to resolve issues before they get to the editor. But at the same time, you know that there is somebody, your boss, that you can go to for the final decision. And I think that today, you know, I don't have the editor to go to for the final decision. The final decision rests with me. The great thing that I find, though, is if you have the right team around you, the right deputy editor, managing editor, assistant editors, and I have a terrific team, then, you know, they can also help you to reach the decisions. I think I'm very lucky in having such a terrific team around me.
I think leadership's a team game. Despite that, does it ever feel like a lonely job being the leader?
Yes, of course. It is lonelier. It is lonelier because, as I said, ultimately the decision does lie with you, and because, you know, people are more likely not to come to you first, which is healthy for an organization. But I think that the team helps to make it less lonely. The fact that you can bounce off ideas, the fact that, you know, I'm close to my team, and, you know, we talk every day. So it makes it less lonely.
So you've also, I think, said that is your role as an editor. You need to be, of course, reflecting and talking about the things that are interesting and relevant to your readership, of course, but perhaps sometimes focusing on things that maybe they should be interested in or ought to be paying more attention to, but maybe aren't at the moment. For example, climate change or gig workers, and I'm sure many other things as well. You know, that feels like quite a fine balance to me. It feels maybe like a piece of elastic. You don't want to be too far ahead, but nevertheless, not just simply holding up a mirror.
Absolutely. I think that that's what one of the issues that is that we're always discussing at the FT. What is relevant to our readers today? But what is also our role is also to highlight what should be relevant to our readers. You mentioned climate change. That is one issue. Another issue that I would mention is diversity. Mm-hmm. I think a couple of years ago, when we used to write about diversity, we didn't have a very good response from our readers. But we have, you know, we've looked at how we cover diversity, and you know, in the last couple of years, diversity has become a much more relevant issue for our readers and for all business leaders. Yeah. So you do have to anticipate.
Yeah.
You have to anticipate. You have to also
shape as well.
Surely be you're... able. You have to shape coverage, and you also have to. You have to sometimes think that to invest in something that may not appear relevant today, but you know that it is going to be relevant. I mean, we invested in the Climate Capital Hub, frankly, exactly at the right time, because climate became a massive issue for readers. Today, for example, our commodities team needs a lot more support, because we are in a commodities cycle, a commodities crisis. A couple of years ago, we weren't, and this is what gets me to something that is extremely important for me and for the FT, and that is flexibility. You have to be able to move people around, to focus on what is important at one point in time, but then also to shift emphasis when that is required. So we built up a team on health and science during the pandemic. And if we weren't flexible, we wouldn't have been able to do this. So you have to not think in silos all the time. Yeah. You have to be able to move people around and move people the way that people think, also shape the way that the staff thinks at times in order to change focus.
And so you've said that the battle against fake news isn't a lost cause. And in 2021, the FT made Elon Musk their person of the year. You can probably guess how I'm going to link these two together. So what do you think of him buying Twitter? I mean, is the whole fuss around it a kind of a classic sort of chattering classes fuss, or does it really matter?
I think it does matter. Of course it matters. I think we have to wait and see what he does with Twitter. From what we know, what's driving him is the whole idea of that Twitter is not really respecting free speech. But the truth is that Elon Musk isn't going to be able to do whatever he wants with Twitter. There's regulation. There are, governments out there, and I think that the EU has already issued a statement warning him. I think that there is a broader issue here, and that is, who is the arbiter of free speech? I certainly wouldn't feel comfortable if Elon Musk was an arbiter of free speech.
No. No, I'm not sure I'd feel comfortable if any individual was the arbiter. Surely, by definition, it can't have an arbiter. That's the problem, isn't it?
Absolutely.
That's the challenge. So you've had a glittering career, and I'm sure there's much more to come. But a question that we always like to ask is about failure. What role have failure or failures played in your success?
I don't know that failure played a role in my success. Do I have regrets? Have I done things that I would have done differently? I think that's definitely the case. I mentioned earlier that one of the things that I wish I had done was to have covered other parts of the world. In particular, I always wanted to cover Russia and China, and I was always sort of told, "Okay, the next time." Yeah. But now the story is too big. And one of the things that I tell journalists today is, I know I stayed in one job for a long time, but don't stay in the job for a long time. Diversify your experience, challenge yourself, and get to know different parts of the world. And definitely, go abroad. This is one of the great things that the FT offers. It's for you to be a foreign correspondent. So accumulate different experiences and as many as you can.
Fantastic. So you're a very busy woman. I've got two questions to finish with. First is a piece of advice. You've been in the job now for nearly 2.5 years. What advice would you give to somebody taking on a new big leadership position as you did 2 years ago?
One is to listen. I think there is a great need right now for leaders to listen. Two, I would say to be willing to change the culture of an organization, but while preserving what is most valuable. And three, I would say, focus on collaborative work. Focus on getting people to work together and to understand that working together is what produces the best work. So teamwork, and have a great team around you.
Yeah,
that's always the best advice to leaders.
I agree. I mean, it is a cliche, but it really, really is true. And quite hard to do. I mean, it's not an easy thing to achieve that. And my final question: what next?
Next?
Yeah. What dreams do you still have? That's a great answer. We might just end on that. Next. Fantastic. Well, Rula, it's been an absolute inspiration talking to you. Thank you so much. We're genuinely honoured.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
We're genuinely honoured to have had you on. So thank you so much. And you better go and catch your plane. If you enjoyed this podcast, please take a moment to rate and review No Bullshit Leadership on Apple Podcasts. It lets us know what you think and helps others to find the show. Thank you.